Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Rundown for July 27, 2026. This week, we indexed 143 new orthopedic studies across 34 journals. The 75 highest impact studies are featured on the site, and we're covering the top 25 studies in this audio digest. As always, studies are ranked by our impact algorithm, which weighs journal tier and level of evidence. Let's start with our first study. Nelson and colleagues published in Lancet, titled Dual Mobility Total Hip Replacement in Fractures. Stability promotes patient confidence. The abstract for this article was not available in PubMed at the time of processing. Please refer to the original publication in Lancet for full details. One limitation to note is the abstract was not available for analysis. Moving on, Komargotsky and colleagues published in JAAOS, titled Non-Steroidal Anti-Inflammatory Drug Use and Bone Healing, an umbrella review with a reconstructed meta-analysis. This umbrella review and reconstructed meta-analysis evaluated whether non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs impair bone healing across subgroups defined by age, fracture type, dose, and duration. Pooling 38 primary studies, NSAID use was associated with increased non-union risk. Odds ratio 1.56, 95% confidence interval 1.18 to 2.11, but not delayed union. Risk was significant in adults at 1.67, but not in pediatric patients at 0.77. Higher in long bone fractures than spinal fusion, and absent with 14 days or less of exposure. Most included reviews were rated low or critically low quality by AmSTAR 2. One limitation to note is most included systematic reviews were rated low or critically low quality, meaning the reconstructed meta-analysis inherits substantial heterogeneity and potential selection bias. Moving on, Park and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Cost-Effectiveness of Biportal Endoscopic Spine Surgery Compared with Microscopic Surgery for Lumbar Degenerative Diseases, a pooled analysis of two randomized controlled trials. This economic evaluation pooled two Korean multicenter randomized controlled trials to compare biportal endoscopic spine surgery versus microscopic spine surgery across 187 patients using cost per QLE from the healthcare provider perspective. Mean one-year QLEs were 0.823 for biportal endoscopic spine surgery and 0.801 for microscopic spine surgery. Total costs were $3,028 versus $3,080. With confidence intervals for both incremental costs and QLEs crossing zero. At the Korean willingness to pay threshold, bootstrapped analysis with 5,000 iterations yielded a 94.9% probability that biportal endoscopic spine surgery is cost-effective. One limitation to note is the willingness to pay threshold of $21,429 per QLE is specific to the Korean healthcare system and may not transfer to higher-cost systems like the US or Western Europe. Moving on, Cao and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled Does Total Hip Arthroplasty Offer Clinically Important Benefits Over Hemiarthroplasty for Femoral Neck Fracture in Patients Age 65 Years or Older? A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This PRISMA-compliant meta-analysis, restricted to randomized controlled trials, compared total hip arthroplasty versus hemiarthroplasty for displaced femoral neck fractures in patients 65 years or older, explicitly excluding duplicate cohort data and non-randomized studies that confounded prior syntheses. Total hip arthroplasty showed no reduction in revision, mortality, or composite hip-related complications, while increasing dislocation risk and requiring 31 more minutes of operative time with 115 milliliters greater blood loss. The 5-point Harris-Hibbs score advantage for total hip arthroplasty fell below the 10-point minimum clinically important difference threshold, and grade certainty was moderate for most outcomes except functional scores, which were low. One limitation to note is follow-up duration varies substantially across included trials, meaning late complications such as acetabular erosion after hemiarthroplasty, which typically manifest beyond 5 years, are systematically underrepresented. Overall, in 18 randomized controlled trials of 2,908 patients 65 years or older with displaced femoral neck fractures, total hip arthroplasty conferred no clinically important functional benefit over hemiarthroplasty, with a Harris-Hibbs score difference of just 5 points. below the 10-point minimum clinically important difference, and doubled dislocation risk, favoring hemiarthroplasty. Moving on. Macchiacciara and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Lateral Extra-Articular Procedures Decrease Rates of Graft Failure and Positive Pivot Shift in Primary Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, a systematic review and meta-analysis. This systematic review and meta-analysis of 12 level 1-2 randomized controlled trials asked whether adding a lateral extra-articular procedure to primary hamstring autograft anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction improves outcomes versus anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction alone. Lateral extra-articular procedures significantly reduced graft failure and positive pivot shift rates and improved Lysholm scores. International Knee Documentation Committee and Tegner scores showed no significant between-group difference, though ceiling effects were identified in 75% or greater of studies reporting those measures. One limitation to note is pooling all reconstruction and lateral extra-articular tenodesis types as a single category obscures whether one lateral procedure is superior. Overall, adding a lateral extra-articular procedure to primary anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with hamstring autograft significantly reduces graft failure and positive pivot shift rates across 1,327 patients in 12 randomized controlled trials. Moving on, Hu and colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled Preoperative Gait Analysis Predicts Surgical Candidacy and Clinical Severity in Hip Osteoarthritis. This single-center study compared preoperative three-dimensional gait analysis findings against clinical and radiographic variables in total hip arthroplasty candidates versus matched non-operative controls, then assessed whether BAIT parameters improved 12-month outcome prediction. Step length and knee range of motion correlated positively with joint space width, and atypical gait cycles on the affected side correlated with pain severity and functional status. Gait parameters did not improve prediction of 12-month pain, but did improve prediction of functional outcomes, with the combined model yielding an AUC of 0.953 for surgical candidacy discrimination. One limitation to note is the sample size is unreported, making it impossible to evaluate whether the study was adequately powered or to assess potential overfitting of the 0.953 AUC. Overall, a combined model of preoperative gait parameters plus clinical variables achieved an AUC of 0.953 for discriminating surgical candidacy in hip osteoarthritis, outperforming clinical variables alone. Moving on, Yamamoto and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled What is the Diagnostic Accuracy of Clinical Examination and Dynamic Radiographs for Acute Vertebral Compression Fractures in Older Adults, a prospective study. This prospective study evaluated the diagnostic accuracy of clinical examination and dynamic radiographs against MRI, CT, or sequential radiographs as reference standards in 136 patients 50 years or older with acute thoracolumbar pain. The closed fist percussion test yielded 93% sensitivity but only 20% specificity. Sitting lateral radiographs achieved 77% sensitivity and 86% specificity at the patient level, and 99% specificity with a likelihood ratio positive of 51 at the vertebral level. Bayesian sequential integration of these tests raised post-test probability from 22% to 97%, supporting selective MRI use. One limitation to note is the composite reference standard, MRI in only 63% of patients, with CT and sequential radiographs substituted in 37%, means the true sensitivity and specificity are calculated against imperfect surrogates in over one-third of the cohort. Overall, a stepwise approach combining closed fist percussion test at 93% sensitivity and sitting lateral radiographs at 99% vertebral level specificity with a likelihood ratio positive of 51, increased post-test probability of acute vertebral compression fracture from 22% to 97%. Moving on, Vandermaiden and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Comparable Midterm Outcomes for Ultrasound-Guided Needling versus high-energy shockwave therapy for rotator cuff calcific tendonitis, a randomized controlled trial. This randomized controlled trial compared high-energy extracorporeal shockwave therapy, 4 sessions, versus single-session ultrasound-guided needling and lavage for symptomatic rotator cuff calcific tendonitis greater than 5 millimeters, Gaertner type 1-2, refractory to conservative care, including subacromial corticosteroid injection. At mean 6.8 years, constant Mirrli scores, disabilities of the arm, shoulder, and hand scores, and visual analog scale pain scores were statistically equivalent between groups at 94.4 versus 93.3. No deposit recurrence occurred in treated tendons, though 15% of ultrasound-guided needling patients developed new deposits in a different rotator cuff tendon, and additional treatments were required by 42% of extracorporeal shockwave therapy and 26% of ultrasound-guided needling patients. One limitation to note is high rates of additional treatment in both groups without standardized rescue protocols make it impossible to determine how much improvement is attributable to the index intervention versus subsequent care. Overall, at mean 6.8 year follow-up, extracorporeal shockwave therapy and ultrasound-guided needling produced equivalent constant Mirrli scores of 94.4 versus 93.3, with 94% of both groups achieving the minimum clinically important difference for rotator cuff calcific tendonitis. Moving on, Liu and colleagues published in Spine, titled Natural Progression Patterns of Lumbar Spondylolisthesis and Low-Grade Spondylolisthesis in Late Adolescence, a multicentral, non-interventional, longitudinal cohort study. This multicenter longitudinal study tracked 154 skeletally mature adolescents with bilateral lumbar spondylolisthesis or low-grade spondylolisthesis under non-interventional observation to define natural multidimensional progression rates. Slip progression occurred in only 7.1%. while MRI-confirmed intervertebral disc degeneration progression occurred in 30.5%, low back pain progression in 44.2%, and neurogenic symptom progression in 4.5%, yielding a 56.5% overall multidimensional progression rate. Post-hoc logistic regression identified L5-level lesion, sarcopenia, and sedentary behavior as independent risk factors for overall progression. One limitation to note is symptomatic progression endpoints relied on retrospectively extracted records rather than prospectively collected, validated patient-reported outcome measures. Overall, over a median 10.5-year follow-up, only 7.1% of skeletally mature adolescents with lumbar spondylolisthesis or low-grade spondylolisthesis showed slip progression, but 56.5% demonstrated multidimensional progression driven primarily by disc degeneration at 30.5% and low back pain at 44.2%. Moving on, Liu and colleagues published in International Orthopedics, titled Patient-Specific Instrumentation Improves Technical Execution Accuracy After Artificial Intelligence-Assisted Preoperative Planning in Medial Unicompartmental Knee Arthroplasty. This randomized controlled trial asked whether patient-specific instrumentation provides additional technical accuracy beyond artificial intelligence-assisted preoperative planning alone in medial unicompartmental knee arthroplasty. A novel CT module using a UNET plus transformer hybrid drove CT-based planning and patient-specific instrumentation design. 24 patients received patient-specific instrumentation-assisted surgery, and 24 received conventional instrumentation after identical artificial intelligence planning. Patient-specific instrumentation significantly improved tibial component positioning, tibial coverage, and proximal tibial resection accuracy, and artificial intelligence planning outperformed conventional templating for implant size prediction. But Oxford Knee Score, visual analog scale, and satisfaction were equivalent at short-term follow-up. One limitation to note is follow-up is short-term and underpowered for clinical outcomes, making it impossible to determine whether the demonstrated radiographic accuracy improvements affect implant survivorship or revision rates. Overall, adding patient-specific instrumentation to artificial intelligence-assisted preoperative planning, significantly improved tibial component positioning accuracy in medial unicompartmental knee arthroplasty compared to artificial intelligence-assisted planning alone. But short-term Oxford Knee Score, visual analog scale, and satisfaction scores did not differ between groups. Moving on, Castagnini and colleagues published in JAAOS titled Predictors of Iliopsoas Impingement After Total Hip Arthroplasty with Overhanging Acetabular Components. This retrospective case control study asked which CT measured positional parameters differentiate protruding cups causing symptomatic iliopsoas impingement from asymptomatic protruding cups. 35 CT confirmed symptomatic total hip arthroplasties were compared to 17 asymptomatic total hip arthroplasties with comparable protrusion magnitude across cup antiversion, sagittal tilt, diameter mismatch, offsets, and leg length discrepancy. Firth penalized logistic regression identified acetabular diameter mismatch as the sole independent predictor with an odds ratio of 1.33, 95% confidence interval 1.09 to 2.26. While antiversion and sagittal tilt showed large univariate effect sizes but lost independence in the multivariate model. One limitation to note is the asymptomatic control group is too small and potentially biased by survivorship, as patients with mild symptoms may have been lost to follow-up. Overall, among total hip arthroplasties with cup protrusion, acetabular component oversizing was the only independent predictor of symptomatic iliopsoas impingement. Viewich and colleagues published in Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled De-implementation of Routine Radiographs in the Follow-up of Wrist and Ankle Fractures in Dutch Hospitals. This multicenter retrospective study across five Dutch hospitals evaluated whether evidence dissemination alone versus a structured de-implementation program reduced routine follow-up radiographs for distal radius fractures and malleolar fractures. In Warrior Trial Experience Centers, dissemination reduced routine radiographs by 1.41 per patient for malleolar fractures and 0.71 for distal radius fractures. De-implementation added a further significant reduction only for malleolar fractures at 0.26 additional. In non-trial centers, active de-implementation increased the probability of no routine follow-up imaging by 21.9% for distal radius fractures and 11.4% for malleolar fractures beyond dissemination alone. One limitation to note is the sequential cohort design cannot exclude confounding from concurrent system-level changes occurring between the historical and intervention periods. Overall, a tailored de-implementation strategy reduced routine follow-up radiographs per patient by an additional 0.38 for malleolar fractures and 0.30 for distal radius fractures, beyond what evidence dissemination alone achieved in non-Warrior trial centers. Moving on, Iyer and colleagues published in JAAOS titled Predictive Factors for Manipulations Under Anesthesia After Total Knee Arthroplasty, an analysis of 15,139 cases. This study queried the Premier Healthcare Database from 2015 to 2021 to identify preoperative and perioperative predictors of manipulation under anesthesia within 90 days of primary total knee arthroplasty. Mixed effects modeling identified younger age at 62.47 versus 67.03 years, female sex, and black race as independent risk factors for manipulation under anesthesia, while perioperative dexamethasone, daily prednisone, and angiotensin II receptor blocker use were protective. The overall manipulation under anesthesia rate was 1.55%, consistent with published incidence ranges. One limitation to note is the database cannot confirm whether dexamethasone and angiotensin II receptor blocker use reflect a direct antifibrotic mechanism or serve as proxies for healthier, better optimized patients, introducing significant confounding by indication. Overall, in 975,235 total knee arthroplasties, 1.55% required manipulation under anesthesia within 90 days, with perioperative dexamethasone, daily prednisone, and angiotensin II receptor blocker use independently reducing manipulation under anesthesia risk. Moving on, Singh and colleagues published in JAAOS, titled Evaluating the Complication Profile of Inpatient, Outpatient ASC, and Office-Based Percutaneous Kyphoplasty for Osteoporotic Vertebral Compression Fractures. This study used PearlDiver to compare 90-day complication profiles of kyphoplasty performed in inpatient, outpatient ASC, and outpatient office settings for osteoporotic vertebral compression fractures from 2016 to 2022, with one-to-one matching by age, sex, and Charlson comorbidity index. Inpatient cases had the highest odds of acute kidney injury, cardiac arrest, deep vein thrombosis, pneumonia, transfusion, urinary tract infection, wound complications, and readmission. Office-based cases had the lowest medical complication burden, but the highest odds of nerve injury and secondary fractures. And office-based volume grew from 21.7% to 29.6% of annual cases over the study period. One limitation to note is claims-based data cannot distinguish whether higher nerve injury and secondary fracture rates in the office setting reflect true procedural risk or systematic selection of more complex fracture patterns routed to that setting. Overall, office-based kyphoplasty had lower rates of most medical complications versus inpatient and outpatient ASC settings, but carried the highest odds of nerve injury and secondary fractures in a matched cohort of 71,084 patients. Moving on, Koshinsky and colleagues published in Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics titled The Hidden Injury, Behavioral Health's Role in Pediatric Orthopedic Outcomes, a Systematic Review. This systematic review examined the role of behavioral health factors in recovery and return to sport outcomes across pediatric orthopedic conditions using CRISMA methodology across PubMed, Cochrane, and Ovid Medline. The most frequently studied conditions were anterior cruciate ligament injuries, general sport injuries, and adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. Psychological distress when unmanaged was consistently associated with worse outcomes. The authors conclude that integrated behavioral health services, standardized screening, and multidisciplinary clinic models are needed to optimize care. One limitation to note is the inclusion of adult and mixed-age populations without consistent age-stratified subgroup analysis prevents definitive conclusions specific to skeletally immature pediatric patients. Overall, across 197 included articles, unaddressed psychological distress, most studied in anterior cruciate ligament injury, general sport injuries, and adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, negatively impacts return to sport and postoperative outcomes in pediatric orthopedic patients. Moving on, Ostrom and colleagues published in JAAOS, titled Chlorhexidine Gluconate and Hypersensitivity from 2-octyl cyanoacrylate mesh dressings. This retrospective study compared a standard saline wipe versus an enhanced isopropyl alcohol then saline removal protocol of 2% chlorhexidine gluconate and 70% isopropyl alcohol skin prep before 2-octyl cyanoacrylate mesh dressing application in hip and knee arthroplasty. The enhanced protocol reduced hypersensitivity from 14.5% to 2.6%. Both reactions in the enhanced group occurred in patients with known adhesive allergy. No differences were found in delayed wound healing, superficial infection, or deep infection, though folliculitis was higher in the enhanced group at 3.9% versus 0%. One limitation to note is the retrospective, non-randomized design cannot exclude that temporal changes in surgical technique, patient selection, or dressing application practice, rather than the wash protocol itself, drove the reduction in hypersensitivity rates. Overall, an enhanced chlorhexidine removal protocol before 2-octyl cyanoacrylate mesh dressing application reduced hypersensitivity reactions from 14.5% to 2.6% in hip and knee arthroplasty patients. Moving on, Najjar and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Reassessing Bladder Recovery in Cauda Equina Syndrome, Long-Term Outcomes After Surgical Decompression, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This PRISMA-compliant systematic review and random effects meta-analysis evaluated long-term bladder outcomes after surgical decompression for degenerative cauda equina syndrome across 16 observational studies. Pooled prevalence of persistent bladder dysfunction was 32.6%, 95% confidence interval, 23.4% to 41.9% at final follow-up. Among those with preoperative dysfunction, 46.8% retained dysfunction. Evidence on surgical timing effect was heterogeneous and inconclusive, One limitation to note is extreme statistical heterogeneity, driven by non-standardized bladder outcome definitions across included studies, renders the pooled prevalence estimate unreliable for precise prognostic counseling. Overall, persistent bladder dysfunction occurs in 32.6% of patients at 12 months or greater after surgical decompression for degenerative cauda equina syndrome, rising to 46.8% in those presenting with preoperative urinary retention. Moving on, Manoj and colleagues published in Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled The Role of Perfusion MRI in Detecting Avascular Necrosis of the Femoral Head in Children, a systematic review. This systematic review evaluated perfusion MRI and contrast-enhanced MRI as diagnostic and prognostic tools for femoral head avascular necrosis in patients under 18 with developmental dysplasia of the hip, slipped capital femoral epiphysis, or leg calvae perthes disease. 9 studies assess screening accuracy at 90% sensitivity, 60% specificity, 58% positive predictive value, and 90% negative predictive value, and 4 assessed prognostic value in leg calvae perthes disease, consistently linking femoral head hypoperfusion to higher herring lateral pillar class, increased deformity index, and worse sphericity deviation scores. Heterogeneity across studies and small total sample size limit definitive conclusions. One limitation to note is only 13 studies with 538 patients across 3 distinct diagnoses were pooled, making subgroup-level diagnostic accuracy estimates for each diagnosis individually underpowered. Overall, perfusion MRI achieves 90% sensitivity and 90% negative predictive value for avascular necrosis detection in pediatric hip disorders across 538 patients. But specificity is only 60% with a positive predictive value of 58%, limiting its utility as a rule-in test. Moving on. Polam and colleagues published in Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled Lower Postoperative Geriatric Nutritional Risk Index is Associated with Increased Complications and Reoperations Following Shoulder Arthroplasty. This retrospective cohort study evaluated whether postoperative geriatric nutritional risk index, calculated from serum albumin and body weight, predicts complications and patient-reported outcomes after primary anatomic or reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. Patients with postoperative geriatric nutritional risk index less than 109, comprising 28.6% of the cohort, had complication rates of 18.0% versus 2.4%, and reoperation rates of 10.0% versus 2.4% compared to nutritionally normal patients. On multivariable logistic regression adjusted for age and sex, geriatric nutritional risk index less than 109 independently predicted complications and reoperation, while American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeon Score, Single Assessment Numeric Evaluation, Visual Analog Scale Pain, and VR12 scores were equivalent between groups at final follow-up. One limitation to note is the retrospective design with a single-center cohort of 175 patients limits causal inference and generalizability. Overall, postoperative geriatric nutritional risk index less than 109 confers a 13.19-fold increased odds of any complication and 6.21-fold increased odds of reoperation following total shoulder arthroplasty, despite equivalent long-term patient-reported outcomes and range of motion. Moving on, Kulam and colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled Preoperative Factors Associated with Achieving Patient-Acceptable Symptom State After Robot-Assisted Total Hip Arthroplasty Differ According to the Outcome Measure Used. This single-center retrospective study of a prospective cohort examined preoperative predictors of achieving patient-acceptable symptom state after robot-assisted total hip arthroplasty using 4 patient-reported outcome measures at 12 months. Multivariable analysis identified pelvic incidence minus lumbar lordosis mismatch greater than negative 10 degrees, absence of low back pain, and tennis grade 3 as universal predictors across all 4 measures. Male sex, age 55 or greater, and numeric rating scale pain less than 7 predicted patient acceptable symptom state on 3 of 4 measures. Non-smoking status predicted patient acceptable symptom state on numeric rating scale and Harris hip score, while higher socioeconomic status predicted patient acceptable symptom state on selected patient-reported outcome measures, confirming that each instrument captures distinct recovery dimensions. One limitation to note is the 12-month follow-up is insufficient to capture late functional gains or patient acceptable symptom state threshold shifts. Overall, across 368 robot-assisted total hip arthroplasty patients, spinopelvic mismatch at pelvic incidence minus lumbar lordosis greater than negative 10 degrees, absence of low back pain, and tennis grade 3 were the only three preoperative factors independently associated with achieving patient acceptable symptom state on all four patient-reported outcome measures at 12 months. Moving on, Bacon colleagues published in Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled "Does Teres Minor Trophicity Affect Outcomes After Arthroscopically Assisted Lower Trapezius Tendon Transfer in Irreparable Posterior Superior Rotator Cuff Tears?" This study asked whether preoperative teres minor trophicity on MRI predicts outcomes after arthroscopically assisted lower trapezius tendon transfer in 104 patients with irreparable posterior superior rotator cuff tears. Patients were stratified into hypertrophic, normal, and hypotrophic groups, with outcomes assessed via visual analog scale, constant, and American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeon scores at mean 45.3 months. All groups achieved significant improvements in pain, function, and range of motion, with no statistically significant intergroup differences in postoperative scores, re-tear rates, or minimum clinically important difference achievement. One limitation to note is the hypertrophic group comprised only 13 patients, providing insufficient statistical power to exclude a clinically meaningful difference for the subgroup where teres minor dysfunction is most pronounced. Overall, teres minor trophicity does not significantly affect postoperative visual analog scale, constant, or American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeon scores after arthroscopically assisted lower trapezius tendon transfer for irreparable posterior superior rotator cuff tears at mean 45.3 months follow-up. Moving on, Pishirodian colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled "National Case Volume and Economic Burden of Inpatient Revision Hip Arthroplasty for Aseptic Loosening: Trends and Future Projections from 2012 to 2032. This study queried a nationally representative weighted hospital admissions database to characterize annual incidence and inpatient costs of revision total hip arthroplasty for aseptic loosening from 2012 to 2022, with projections to 2032. Pre-pandemic annual volumes declined modestly from 11,070 in 2012 to 9,650 in 2019, then fell sharply to 5,894 in 2021. Inflation-adjusted cost per admission rose 9.2% over the study period and is projected to increase an additional 15.8% by 2032. One limitation to note is post-pandemic volume data through 2022 remain depressed and may reflect deferred care rather than a true secular decline, making 2032 projections potentially unreliable. Overall, inflation-adjusted cost per inpatient revision total hip arthroplasty for aseptic loosening rose from $28,810 in 2012 to $31,461 in 2022, and is projected to reach $36,424 by 2032, while annual case volume declined from 11,070 to 9,650 pre-pandemic, and collapsed to 5,894 in 2021. Moving on, Kahana Rojkind and colleagues published in American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled "Minimum 5-Year Outcomes After Arthroscopic Subspine Decompression in Patients with Femoral Acetabular Impingement." This propensity-matched retrospective cohort evaluated minimum 5-year patient-reported outcomes, survivorship, and clinically meaningful improvement after arthroscopic subspine decompression concurrent with femoral acetabular impingement correction versus matched femoral acetabular impingement only controls. All five patient reported outcomes improved significantly in the subspine decompression group, with minimum clinically important difference and patient acceptable symptom state achievement rates comparable to controls. Total hip arthroplasty or resurfacing conversion rate was 5.3% in the subspine decompression group, and time to revision arthroscopy was significantly longer in the subspine decompression cohort, versus controls at 52.0 versus 32.8 months. One limitation to note is the absence of standardized, validated diagnostic criteria for the subspine decompression indication across the study period introduces heterogeneity in patient selection. Overall, arthroscopic subspine decompression concurrent with femoroacetabular impingement correction yields 94.7% survivorship at minimum 5-year follow-up, with minimum clinically important difference and patient acceptable symptom state achievement rates statistically equivalent to matched femoroacetabular impingement only controls. Moving on, Pishorodi and colleagues published in Journal of Orthopedic Surgery and Research, titled Projected Case Volume and Economic Burden of Knee Aseptic Loosening in Inpatient Total Knee Arthroplasty in the United States. Using a nationally representative inpatient database, this study quantified annual revision total knee arthroplasty admissions for aseptic loosening from 2012 to 2022 and projected volumes and costs to 2032. National admission volume rose from 15,355 in 2012 to 18,775 in 2018, before pandemic-related decline. Cost per admission rose from $30,920 to $34,748 over the same period. Pre-pandemic trend modeling projects 30,605 annual cases and $927 million in total inpatient costs by 2032. One limitation to note is projections rely on pre-pandemic linear trends and cannot account for deferred pandemic cases, shifts toward outpatient total knee arthroplasty, or improvements in implant fixation that may alter future loosening rates. Overall, revision total knee arthroplasty for aseptic loosening is projected to reach 30,605 cases per year by 2032, with total inpatient costs approaching $927 million annually, a 95% increase from 2012. And finally, Quesada Jimenez and colleagues published an American Journal of Sports Medicine titled Revision Hip Arthroscopy, Propensity Score Matched Comparison of Labral Reconstruction versus Repair with Minimum 5-Year Outcomes. This study compared minimum 5-year patient-reported outcomes of labral reconstruction versus labral repair in revision hip arthroscopy using 1-to-1 propensity score matching, controlling for age, body mass index, sex, acetabular outer bridge grade, and capsular treatment. Both groups showed significant improvement in modified Harris hip score, non-arthritic hip score, hip outcome score, sports-specific subscale, visual analog scale pain, and satisfaction from baseline, with no between-group differences in minimum clinically important difference or patient acceptable symptom state achievement rates. Secondary surgery rates, including re-revision arthroscopy and conversion to arthroplasty, were equivalent between groups. One limitation to note is the small matched cohort of 68 patients limits statistical power to detect meaningful differences in secondary surgery rates and subgroup outcomes by tear morphology. Overall, in revision hip arthroscopy, labral reconstruction and labral repair achieve comparable minimum clinically important difference and patient acceptable symptom state rates across all patient-reported outcomes at minimum 5-year follow-up, with no significant difference in re-revision or conversion to arthroplasty rates. That wraps up this week's Ortho Digest Rundown, 25 studies reviewed. Head to orthodigest.com for the full write-ups.